You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. News from the fairground, with photographs by Greg Williams. Bonne nuit. Vanity Fair and Prada welcomed the bright lights of this year's Cannes Film Festival to a swank evening at the Hotel du Cap Edenrock. In the photos, Jeff Bezos and his now fiancée, Lauren Sanchez, Ashley Graham, Rachel Sinnott, the Idol's pitch-perfect pop star assistant, Emily in Paris star Lucien Laviscount with Matthias Schweighofer, who plays Werner Heisenberg in Oppenheimer, Shonette Renee Wilson, Vanity Fair editor-in-chief Radhika Jones, and Robert De Niro, the latter fresh from the premiere of Killers of the Flower Moon, Naomi Aki, Damson Idris, Manu Rios, who broke out in Elite, Bryan Cranston, and Jones. On the Vanity Fair agenda, an event. Mrs. Davis' special advanced screening. A rapt audience got a sneak peek of the critically acclaimed series Mrs. Davis at the Metrograph in New York City on April 18th. Creators Tara Hernandez and Damon Lindelof joined star Betty Gilpin for a Q&A moderated by Vanity Fair's Anthony Bresnahan. After the panel, attendees mingled in the lobby with show-themed cocktails and bites. The Deep End, The Best New Books for the Beach and Beyond by Keziah Weir. Evidence of Things Seen, Sarah Weinman. Edited by Weinman, this incisive collection of true crime reporting spans from Mae Jong's Vanity Fair story on the Atlanta spa shooting victims to Amanda Knox's essay on narrative ownership, published by Echo. Zero Sum, Joyce Carol Oates, an electric story collection from a lit icon and Twitter star. One woman gently sets her daughter out with the trash. Girls lay a sticky trap for their community's hidden sex pest. Violence simmers and sometimes boils over. Published by Knopf. The Sullivanians, Alexander Still. The author interviewed more than 60 former affiliates of the Sullivan Institute, a psychoanalytic center turned sexually abusive cult, for his disturbing, gripping deep dive. Published by FSG. Easy Money, Ben McKenzie. The OC's McKenzie and journalist Jacob Silverman examined the seedy underbelly of crypto from Sam Bankman-Fried to celeb influencers. Published by Abrams Press. When Crack Was King, Donovan X. Ramsey. With intimacy and precision, Ramsey elucidates two decades of an epidemic exacerbated by structural racism and police brutality through the experience of four affected individuals. Published by One World. The Illices by Samantha Leach. Leach chronicles a trio of early deaths. Her childhood best friend, Elissa, sent to for-profit therapeutic boarding schools for troubled teens, and her classmates there, Elissa and Alyssa, and all three names are spelled differently but pronounced the same, published by Legacy Lit. Banyan Moon, Tao Tai, alienated mother and daughter Hong and Anne are flung together by the death of the family matriarch in Tai's rich novel of inheritance and generational divides, published by Mariner. Owner of a Lonely Heart, Beth Nguyen, the author, whose father fled with her from Saigon in 1975, considers her fraught, scant relationship with her biological mother, other formative material connections, and her own role as mom to her sons in this thoughtful excavation, published by Scribner. The Librarianist, Patrick DeWitt. This engrossing fictional portrait of a retired librarian volunteering at an old folks' home unspools its main character's life, betrayals, loss, triumphs, with humor and tenderness, published by Echo. All Night Pharmacy by Ruth Madievsky. In this vivid debut, an unmoored Angelino follows her older sister Debbie into addiction and pill scams. When Debbie vanishes, our narrator's relationship with a psychic fills the void, for a time. Published by Catapult. The Sunset Crowd by Karen Tanabe. Secrets and power struggles abound in Tanabe's stylish novel of three women angling for immortalization, or at least 15 minutes of fame, in 1970s Hollywood. Published by St. Martin's Press. Hope, Andrew Ridker. In this biting satire, the well-to-do Greenspan family squirms through one very bad year, from its 80-year-old grandmother siphoning her savings to a teen online paramour to the patriarch's alleged medical fraud. Published by Viking. The Girl in the Yellow Poncho by Crystal Brent Zook. Zook contends with childhood abandonment by her white father and describes the black women who raised her in this evocative rumination on growing up biracial in America, published by Duke University. The Apology, Jimin Han. In Han's surreal genre twister from the afterlife, centenarian Zhangge Cha looks back on the family rifts she created while trying to keep up appearances, published by Little Brown. presidential timbre, I watched Hillary Clinton get within steps of the White House. Gretchen Whitmer could go all the way by Jen Palmieri. Opening photo, blue wave. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer is pursuing a bold second-term agenda. He did this for one reason, and one reason only, to throw you off your game. That's what I told Hillary Clinton backstage at Washington University in October 2016, moments away from her second presidential debate with Donald Trump. 2 days prior, the world had learned, thanks to the Access Hollywood tape, that Trump liked to assert power by assaulting women. Trump retaliated by showing up at a pre-debate appearance with women who had accused Bill Clinton of sexual assault. "Yeah, I got that," Clinton responded dryly to my pep talk. "The great news is that it didn't work." I insisted. She had been through worse, and I thought she would be okay, but it was my job as the campaign's communications director to make sure of it. She mustered a serene smile, folded her hands, and slowly shook her head. Nope, didn't work. Gretchen Whitmer, too, has dealt with boorish men, like one on the floor of the Michigan Senate, who leaned over her to say something very inappropriate. The man was older, but she was the minority leader and senior to him. "Keep in mind, I outrank this guy. He's looming over me, and of course, I am the one who has to go through all the mental gymnastics about how I respond to his offensive comment," she said in a lament familiar to all women. She stood, waiting to speak until she could look him in the eye, and said forcefully but with a smile, "What the F is wrong with you? You can't talk to me that way." Whitmer didn't have the pressure of considering how millions of TV viewers and voters might judge her ability to withstand the pressure of being president on this interaction. Clinton would later speculate that people might have liked to see some fire from her in responding to Trump pacing behind her on the debate stage, but in the moment what was most critical was for her to keep her cool. For Whitmer, that encounter in the state Senate was seminal. She would not quietly tolerate misogynistic behavior as women before her had to do. Her lewd male colleague learned a lesson other foes, including Trump, would come to know. Whitmer doesn't go looking for trouble, but if you come for her, she will punch you in the mouth. It is a disservice to Whitmer that she is perhaps known more for her outlandish things men have done to her, showing up at her home and office wielding guns, voting to strip her of her emergency powers to manage the pandemic, plotting to kidnap and assassinate her, than for her political acumen and what she has accomplished. But as a woman leader who came into the national spotlight during the Trump era, combating the torrent of misogynistic energy the 2016 campaign unleashed in the world has been a defining feature of Whitmer's job. I see Whitmer battling the same forces Clinton faced, but am encouraged. This time, the men who tried to stop the woman are paying for their actions. Republican legislative leaders in Michigan who fought Whitmer lost control of the legislature. Many of the plotters are in jail. Even Trump, who tormented both Clinton and Whitmer, continues to face consequences as his legal troubles mount. Whitmer recently commented that the country is long overdue for a strong female chief executive, begging the question of whether America will elect a woman front and center while asserting that a woman would do the job better than a man. And no, Whitmer is not planning a primary challenge to Joe Biden this time around. I am not one of the people who buys into the self-actualizing bullshit that a woman can't win the presidency. Clinton proved it's possible. She got more votes. Having interviewed Whitmer for Showtime's The Circus, and based on my 3 decades in the political trenches, I could see she had the talent, drive, and toughness to be a solid national candidate. But earlier this year, I headed to Michigan to pressure test that notion by observing how those qualities came to be, and what all of it may say about Whitmer's or any woman's chances of being elected president. Whitmer sets her alarm for 5:02 a.m. every morning, not 5 a.m., 5:02 a.m. I made sure to arrive early at her residence in Lansing, as I had met her enough times to know that if you show up on time, you will be late. Nevertheless, the governor was already striding down the hallway, ready to start her 10 a.m. child care roundtable event at 9:50, and calling out, "Hi, Jen," as I came through the door. The week I spent trailing her in Michigan was a blur of activity. On Tuesday, Whitmer signed a $150 million supplemental appropriations bill that the state legislature had passed with historic speed. The next day, she signed a bill to move up Michigan's presidential primary. Thursday was a child care event, followed by appearances before legislators considering new economic bills and a Galentine's Day reception at her home. She rolled out a new policy in Detroit on Friday to benefit geographically and economically disadvantaged businesses, gave a speech to a group of more than 1,000 educators, and reached a deal with the legislature on a major new tax plan. More recently, when 3 students were killed at a mass shooting in Whitmer's beloved alma mater of Michigan State, she said the time for only thoughts and prayers was over and moved forward a gun safety package the legislature approved. Whitmer describes herself as a progressive Democrat, but observing her up close, I see her core ideology as getting shit done. At the Galentine's Day reception, she remarked that if you want to get something done, give it to a busy woman. Whitmer's office has a lot of busy women. The 4-person senior team is all female, and the operation seems to be in constant motion, yet calm and empowered. Their demeanor does not change in Whitmer's presence, and they don't shy away from telling her tough truths. It is a clarity too often lacking in political organizations. Whitmer's team operates with a speed and confidence I rarely see. As a former aide who remains close to Whitmer put it to me, no matter what the issue is, the process for moving forward is always the same. Find the partners, build the coalition, get the thing done. First elected to the Michigan House of Representatives in 2000 at age 29, Whitmer has never lost an election. She next served for nearly a decade in the Michigan Senate, becoming the state's first female Senate minority leader. Anyone who understands governing and politics respects her ability. Jeff Timmer, a Michigan-based political strategist and erstwhile Republican who once produced television ads against Whitmer when she ran for the Michigan House, told me, after Whitmer was term-limited out of the state Senate in 2014, she thought she was done with electoral politics. As she describes it, a number of powerful men abusing the public trust compelled her to get back into politics, starting in 2015, when she finished the term of the Ingham County prosecutor in Lansing, who had been forced out for, wait for it, being part of a sex trafficking ring. It was there Whitmer signed a warrant for Larry Nassar, the U.S. women's gymnastics team doctor, later convicted of sexually abusing hundreds of female athletes. Whitmer went into the 2016 election, having decided to run for governor 2 years later. She thought Clinton would win Michigan and the White House. After Trump won both, she felt more urgency. I filed for office on the first possible day and spent the next 2 years campaigning. She won in 2018 by nearly 10 points. It matters that Whitmer did not have the burden of being Michigan's first female governor. That distinction goes to Jennifer Granholm, now Secretary of Energy under Biden, who was elected in 2002 and won re-election in 2006. There's a singular alienation and judgment women first through the door encounter. For the most current example, witness the constant headwinds Kamala Harris faces as the first woman and first person of color to be vice president. Whitmer's rise has also been part of a sea change in Michigan politics. In 2015, there were 3 women representing Michigan in the House of Representatives, Debbie Dingell, Brenda Lawrence, and Candace Miller. In the Senate, Debbie Stabenow. Today, 6 of Michigan's 13 House seats are held by women. Both the Secretary of State and Attorney General are women. Michigan has its first woman Senate minority leader, first woman Senate majority leader, and 40% of the state legislature is now female. Consider this. Gary Peters, first elected to the Senate in 2014, is the last male office holder to have won a statewide race in Michigan. There's no chit-chatting with Whitmer on the campaign trail. I managed to get one question to her at an event in Pontiac the Sunday before her 2022 re-election. Whitmer looked me in the eye and delivered her economic message with such intensity that I almost felt sorry for Tudor Dixon, her Republican opponent. By 1:30 a.m. on election night, Chief of Staff Joanne Halls knew her boss was going to prevail. The spreadsheet tracking results at their headquarters at the Motor City Casino Hotel in Detroit showed that, in addition to Whitmer winning re-election by a large margin, the Democrats had wrested control of the state Senate. Winning the trifecta was always a long shot. The Democrats hadn't held full control of the state house for 40 years. And the state house of representatives was very much in doubt as Hulls and other staff headed to sleep. By 4:30 a.m., an ebullient Whitmer was waking up Hulls in her hotel room, yelling into the phone, "We won the house." The governor summoned Hulls and Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist to her suite for a prep session ahead of a morning victory press conference with the state house and Senate Democratic leadership. Whitmer told Gilchrist she wanted the visual of the new leaders standing side by side. "We want them to see that something changed last night," she said. Months later, Whitmer was relaxed and happy as she greeted me. She let me know that she was wearing red pants in honor of the Galentine's Day reception she was hosting that afternoon. Except, she pronounced it Galentine, sounding like Saturday Night Live's Cecily Strong parroting Whitmer's Michigan accent. I told her that I owned the same blazer she was wearing. "You know, Tudor Dixon has it too," Whitmer said, "and she bought it after I wore it in public." Whitmer is competitive about everything and relishes every victory for her state, whether it is winning a new auto plant or, as she recalls fondly to me, beating Ohio Governor Mike DeWine in a bet over the Ohio State-Michigan football game 2 years in a row. "That made me happy," Whitmer said. Michigan State school pride is core to Whitmer's identity. When she talks about Michigan's underdog spirit and championship swagger, it's a Spartan, the state's perpetual underdogs to the more academically prestigious University of Michigan way of looking at the world. You don't have to hang around her team long to appreciate how the Spartan spirit runs deep. If a staff person is a Michigan State alum, I was told this information upon introduction. I came to understand that being a Spartan is shorthanded for saying a person is scrappy. They will dive for every ball, and while they are probably going to engage in some trash talk, they don't showboat. Those Spartan sensibilities also make for a great politician. Following Whitmer's speech that day to educators in Detroit, I couldn't get close as she was mobbed by people seeking selfies and hugs on her way out. In a ballroom full of Democrats, it's not surprising the attendees love her, but their reasons stand out as no one talks to me about the job she's done. They talk about her. She's real. She's just a Michigan mom. She doesn't take any crap from anyone. She's one of us. To hear people's gush about a woman's relatability is a refreshing change. It is not a quality voters have traditionally associated with women politicians, but that is changing as a steady stream of women from all backgrounds run for office. Back at the governor's residence, Whitmer and I sat down to talk. In one corner of the living room was Whitmer's woman wall. The wall displays photos of the governor and her daughters, sometimes with political celebrities like Jill Biden and Michelle Obama, as well as books and art by women. She pointed out a cartoon a fan drew of her with that woman written above the governor's head that the artist had turned into a tattoo, a reference to Trump's infamous dismissal of her handling of the COVID crisis. "It's going to be on her leg forever," Whitmer remarked incredulously. "Her toughness can inspire that kind of admiration from people. Also, people have tried to kill her. I am just a normal person in an extraordinary job at an extraordinary time," she told me. Clinton said something similar to me on my first day of the 2016 presidential campaign. "I am just a simple and serious person, and I don't understand why I provoke such rage in some people." Both women seem somewhat perplexed by the hullabaloo about them, accolades and threats, but I see other forces at play here. Having normal women in extraordinary jobs has made for an extraordinary time. Whitmer is upfront about her anger over the kidnapping plot and clear on how it has impacted her and her family. In October 2020, the FBI arrested 13 men suspected of plotting to kidnap Whitmer. Several of the men pleaded guilty, while others were found guilty, acquitted, or are still awaiting trial. Having seen women like Clinton subjected to similar vitriol helped her perspective, but she says her path was set decades prior when her dad gave her a copy of The Four Agreements, the popular self-help book from the 1990s. "Don't take anything personally" is the second agreement. The others are "don't make assumptions," "be impeccable with your word," and "always do your best." Whitmer says she leaned on the powerful agreements, as well as her armor of a leather jacket and bold red lipstick, to get through the toughest days of 2020. Just prior to her first election to the Michigan House in 2000, Whitmer learned her mother, Sherry, had a brain tumor and was on the way to the hospital for emergency surgery. Whitmer recalls her mother, who served as Assistant Attorney General in Michigan, as fierce and apologetic and unapologetic about owning her own space, wearing hot pink blazers to court, exclaiming, "Fuchsia is my power color," and being so relentlessly positive she would say things were super deluxe, even as she was dying from cancer. The governor has described the experience of having to balance caring for her terminally ill mother while starting a family and a career as a defining chapter of her life. The frustration in dealing with health insurance bureaucracies set her internal default to action and made her impatient for results. Having to switch between caring for her mom, caring for her daughter, and being a legislator gave her an ability to focus on short-term tasks without getting overwhelmed by the enormity of all she must do. 5 yards, then 10 yards, don't get distracted by the 100 yards, is how she describes the get-it-done approach she employs to this day. She recounts a story from the hospital waiting room the day of her mom's emergency surgery. Granholm, who was then Michigan's first female attorney general and Sherry's boss, came to the hospital to offer moral support. Whitmer hails from a bipartisan family. Her father, a Republican, was CEO of Michigan Blue Cross Blue Shield. Granholm was seated next to Whitmer in the waiting room when a campaign ad attacking Whitmer came on the hospital television. 24 hours before, that ad would have really upset me, Whitmer told me. Now it's just noise. All that matters, it's what's happening in the room next door. The continuity between the women is striking. The mother worked for the pioneering Granholm. The daughter eventually succeeded Granholm as governor. All three were present, needed to be present, for the moment Whitmer decided to tune out the noise. When Whitmer chose to don a bright fuchsia coat for her 2023 New Year's Day inauguration, casting her leather armor aside, it felt like a reclamation of feminine power. She had survived a pandemic, the kidnapping plot, tough economic times, and even a grim April 2022 afternoon at a Detroit Tigers baseball game where, holed up in a cramped maintenance office for a little privacy, Whitmer learned a jury failed to convict the alleged plotters against her in an initial trial. Observing the governor as she mingled with the all-female guest at the Galentine's Day reception, replete with red velvet cupcakes, proclaiming Happy Galentine's Day from Governor Whitmer, conversation hearts sprinkled on the tables as decor, and pink lemonade, no booze, it's before 5 p.m., the dramatic progress women leaders have made since Clinton's 2016 loss came into sharper relief. This room, consisting of a female governor celebrating dozens of Michigan's most powerful polls who happen to be women, would not have existed just 5 years ago. Another realization clicked in my brain. The experiences Whitmer says have shaped her as a leader, being a single working mom, caring for the sick parent, dealing with harassing men, are unique to women and common to women. That these experiences are commonplace makes her relatable. Each trial has compounded upon itself to make her stronger, more skilled, and turn her into the person before me, an enormous talent coming at a time when America has seen enough women in power that it is more likely to embrace her than be threatened by her. Women no longer have to model themselves after men to be recognized as leaders. I see her now. She is a strong female executive who could be elected president. I can't know what Whitmer's future holds. She may never run for president, or she may find that her strength of taking aggressive action becomes a vulnerability if, as can often happen, the dozens of bold policies she is rushing to enact become unpopular or even end in failure. What matters is the undeniable gains this woman and those surrounding her have made. The overhead lights in the governor's living room flickered on and off. It was 4:50 p.m., time for everyone to go. The governor starts on time, and she ends on time, one guest said to me. No one was offended. It was a room full of busy women. We all had a lot of shit to do. Deja Vu. As the 2024 race crashes into our midst, audiences are getting the feeling that we've been there, seen that, by Brian Stelter. With opening illustration by Pamela Wang, which shows a montage of Trump, Biden, and various political TV commentators. Midway through rewatching an 18-year-old episode of The Office, I had an epiphany. Suddenly, the contours of the 2024 presidential election started to make sense. The series, which ran 2005 to 2013, is a time capsule. Look, these employees all show up in person and slack off without slack. There are no hot desk, just plain desk. And in the universe of The Office, Donald Trump is just a flamboyant reality star who likes to declare, "You're fired." The time in which the show is frozen is, I suppose, why I love to rewatch it. I first got hooked on The Office by watching illicit copies of episodes shared through torrent sites back when Netflix shipped DVDs and Hulu sounded like it pertained to hoops. I liked the characters enough to become a faithful broadcast viewer, though, tuning into NBC for appointment viewing, right at the point in media history where time and day were starting not to matter. Reliving the old episodes made me keenly aware of context. A character's quip about Trump's The Apprentice, innocuous and synergistic then, feels obnoxious now, but mostly it made me conscious about memory. Not only had I forgotten some regular characters, but I had memory-holed entire arcs. Plot twist and cliffhangers and recurring punchlines, everything unfurled almost like I was a first-time viewer, a newcomer to the world of The Office, when in fact I was such a dedicated fan that I once took an office tour of Scranton, Pennsylvania, the show's imagined hub. How could I remember so little? Why didn't I recall more from my last binge? As I worried about the weaknesses of my own recollections, the looming rematch between Trump and President Joe Biden registered differently. While polls have consistently shown that most Americans do not want to replay the 2020 election, we seem bound to anyway. Reruns can be surprisingly seductive, especially if the details are fuzzed over a little or a lot. Familiar characters and settings can be comforting. He said what? He defamed whom? And voters reacted how? Where's the next rally? What will they say next? Shh, the commercials are over. Is this how I remembered it? The United States is a gerontocracy, and most people know it's a problem, even though the political system isn't providing solutions. One poll in mid-2022 found that only 3 in 10 Americans wanted Biden to run again, and barely 4 in 10 wanted Trump to run. But both men are, so they are the main actors in a show that we'll be watching or avoiding for another year plus. With Trump turning 77 and Biden approaching 81, age may be a frame for the entire election. And if this season is, not to belabor the metaphor, a rerun, then Biden is too old is likely to become one of the only storylines. Substitute age with emails and Biden with Hillary Clinton, and you'll see what I mean. Democrats are pre-fuming about it. When I have talked with Biden family members and allies, they don't deny age is a factor. They just express frustration that it gets turned into the only factor. This is in large part due to the incessant repetition of the right-wing media machine, which has redefined Biden as so aged that he cannot possibly lead. And this is the ultimate repeat. There are some new faces this time around, however. Virtually all of the country's top newsrooms have changed leaders in the past couple of years, which might mean less Trump-era barrage, but also a loss of muscle memory. Millennials have been tasked with covering politicians more than twice their age. CNN has elevated Caitlin Collins, 31, to its long vacant 9 p.m. time slot. NBC has a campaign trail star and Dasha Burns, also 31. And CBS has Robert Costa, 37. They exist in one realm of media, reportorial, meant to appeal to all, massively distrusted by MAGA warriors, while conservative commentators like The Daily Wire's Candace Owens, 34, and Fox's Kayleigh McEnany, 35, exist in another. This split is a relatively new phenomenon. Tucker Carlson, 54, was on MSNBC 15 years ago, but it's critical to see it for what it is. The former tries to inform viewers, while the latter seeks to activate voters. And when there's a crossover episode between the realms, there's a collision. Part of why Trump's recent town hall on CNN was so controversial was because it was, for all intents and purposes, a repeat. In the spirit of this column, I rewatched Anderson Cooper's March 2016 town hall with Trump. The similarities were uncanny, right down to the white CNN logo mugs on stage. The main difference was that in 2016, Trump was still a political novelty. Fact-checking was barely a buzzword back then. Cooper did plenty of it, though, while expressing disbelief at some of Trump's boast. "You're the only one who can solve terror problems in Pakistan?" and channeling the audience's exasperation with Trump's childish conduct. After saying that you were going to spill the beans about Heidi Cruz, you retweeted an unflattering picture of her next to a picture of your wife, Cooper said. Come on. Trump, I thought it was fine. She's a pretty woman. Cooper, you're running for President of the United States. Trump, excuse me, I didn't start it. I didn't start it. Cooper, but sir, with all due respect, that's the argument of a 5-year-old. No, it's not, Trump said, adopting another schoolyard approach. Everything about the Trump era was foreshadowed at that earlier town hall. His lies, his deflections, his denialism, and his demagoguery. Cooper caught Trump in multiple contradictions, but Trump's answers weren't the point. The projection of power was. On Jeb Bush, I beat these people badly. On Scott Walker, I hit him very hard. On Rand Paul, I drove Rand Paul out of the race. I learned a lot about Trump when it originally aired. But now, is there anything truly new to learn about the man? Repeats can be as distressing as they are enticing. I had so many flashbacks to 2016 while watching the recent redux, said Amanda Carpenter, Ted Cruz's former communications director turned never-Trump crusader. Carpenter was a paid CNN commentator back when I anchored the network's Reliable Sources program. She told me she thought CNN organized the town hall as a sweetener, an entree to Donald Trump, to say, please let us be part of the 2024 political process. At what cost? While some critics credited Collins for fact-checking, the smartest takes on the night argued that checking Trump doesn't have that effect. The conflict and his bullying of the journalist is the essence of the performance, Washington Post opinion writer Paul Waldman tweeted afterward. It says, we will create our own reality. You have no power over us, and the more frustrated you get, the more we win. That's what was happening when Collins, having interjected truth into yet another Trump yelp, said, the election was not rigged, Mr. President. You can't keep saying that all night long. You cannot keep saying the election was rigged. But Trump could keep saying it, and he did. Collins was not shaken by the spectacle, even when Trump called her nasty, but plenty of her CNN colleagues were perturbed on her behalf. After a late-night private flight home from Manchester, New Hampshire, CNN CEO Chris Licht tried to quell an employee rebellion by telling them that the Trump encounter made a lot of news, a familiar 2016 defense, and that covering Trump will continue to be messy and tricky, but it's our job. He justified the town hall by implicitly raising the idea of political memory loss. Town hall viewers, he said, know what the stakes are in this election in a way that they didn't the day before. The stakes have proved high for Licht, too, who lost his job following Tim Alberta's damning Atlantic profile that outlined a year of fumbles. Have memories of Trump's misconduct already faded? Do memories perhaps need to be jogged? I'm inclined to say yes, since so many news executives and political analysts appear to have succumbed to revisionist history, downplaying Trump's destruction of a shared reality and his shredding of democratic norms. It's hard to even recall that sliver of time after January 6th, when it seemed like Trump was being excommunicated from American politics. Now he has been fully welcomed back, including by media executives who say they want to rebuild trust by sticking to facts, not opinions. But it wasn't an opinion that Trump lied, smeared, and obstructed justice. In the words of NYU journalism professor Jay Rosen, the takeover of right-wing politics by MAGA created a lies and fiction crisis that could not be met within the both sides' comment on a common set of facts system as it then stood. And so the media manipulation continues, even though many individual journalists know better. There will be more town halls, more tiffs, more reruns of reruns. CNN's Trump town hall netted 3.3 million viewers, far fewer than most media experts expected, which I interpret as another sign of Trump fatigue. Normies just don't care. On the other hand, 3.3 million viewers made CNN number one across cable news for the night, so it was curious how the network held off on promoting the win. Trump sensed this reluctance and said the network was traumatized by what took place at the town hall. I think that instead of acting the way they did, they should have said, "We had a tremendous ratings night, one of the best in years, many years, and I spiked the football, right?" One day, after Trump declared victory over CNN, I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts for a Harvard Kennedy School Congress. Seated across from me for dinner was Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark and founder of Republican Voters Against Trump. The town hall was all anyone wanted to talk about. "I thought it was a wake-up call," she said. "People need to understand that this is who we're up against." Longwell has a superpower, and she derives it from the GOP voter focus groups that she convenes in battleground locations. She is able to translate their gripes and grievances into Harvard speak. "In the focus groups, it's all about vibes," she said that night, "and the voters are all in on his vibes." With the first primary election of 2024 still more than 6 months away, Longwell sees an available audience to move past Trump within the GOP. "But you can't beat something with nothing," she said, "and there's no one to fill that void right now. Ron DeSantis and Dino," meaning Democrat in name only, "Robert F. Kennedy Jr., don't appear to be cutting it." Reruns are effective when memories are short. And let's recognize, as we all careen toward the 2024 contest, that some Republican leaders are engaged in a systematic memory-holing effort. They reduce all the Trump objections to a distaste for his mean tweets. Speaking as someone who was on the receiving end, the tweets were among the least controversial aspects of his time in office. The real scandals barely seemed to matter, though, while America was binge-watching Trump. As Amazon and Disney know all too well, both love-based and hate-based binges keep audiences glued to the screens. Another proof point, when Carlson was still on Fox, the network boasted that he had more Democrat viewers than MSNBC had. Is the freshly fired Carlson the one person who could transform the 2024 election from an encore into an all-new episode? I wouldn't go that far, but Longwell pointed out that both he and Trump have created cult-like bonds with audiences. They've both convinced voters that they are the only ones who are telling the truth. These voters and cable news viewers both skew older. The parallel industries of politics and television distinctly feel, to borrow a phrase from one of cable's cringiest episodes of 2023, past their prime. Don Lemon, 57, was wrong to apply the phrase to Nikki Haley, 51, and he lost his job soon afterward. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.